Hello and welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Marshall.
I'm Steven.
And this is the beginning of Season 2.
Season 2!
Woo!
That's right, we did it. We didn't think we'd make it, but we did.
Thanks so much for still listening to us. Season 2, we are in a continuous improvement sort of cycle here at the show. So we're gonna make some changes.
Spend a lot of money on R&D. And since we got that DARPA grant, top notch. Tippy top.
We're gonna weaponize this show.
We've made promises.
So there's gonna be a bit of a change to our schedule. We're still aiming for weekly episodes, but we are going to change just what we do. So this week you're getting our first season opener, another Luc Besson film.
Yeah, as is our tradition.
That's traditional. You gotta go with that now. Once you do it once,
you just have to do it forever.
You just have to do it forever.
Until you run out of Luc Besson movies to review.
Luc Besson, keep making movies.
He needs to step up his game.
I was speaking directly to him there.
Oh, you need
trying
to
that call
up.
Out.
You need to step out of your game, yeah. Or come on, we'll get him on the show.
We'll get Luke on the show.
We'll do Lucy and then... Wait, he's got other ones.
I hope so.
We'll figure it out.
We at least have season 3.
Luke, at us.
Okay, and then so next week we're trying something new. We are watching Star Trek Deep Space Nine, episode by episode. Yeah. And we're gonna tell you what we think of each episode.
Deeper Space Nine.
We're still workshopping the name.
Deepest Space Nine. No.
If you have suggestions for what we could call this recurring episode,
this theme segment.
Centered around Deep Space Nine. I don't know, maybe something about the prophets.
Oh yeah, nice, like with an F.
yes, that's exactly what I was thinking.
The House of the Prophets,
the Temple of the Prophets. What do they call it? Yeah.
Two minds are better than one, right?
Yeah.
So we're gonna try and do sort of alternating. One week you'll get a Star Trek, Deep Space Nine, and then the next week you'll get new content from us.
We've actually learned that people are really nice, and if you just ask them to talk to you, they'll generally share their thoughts and opinions with you.
Yeah, which is why I'm asking you, what should we call this?
I think we've got actually a pretty great lineup of guests.
We do an incredible lineup of guests coming up.
Yeah, I feel like. I don't mean to build your expectations up, but get them way high.
big expectations. Who do we have? SB Divya.
Yep,
going to be on the show.
Going to be on the show coming at us. Rick Harp.
Rick Harp's going to be on the show. Yeah. Alvaro Zenos Amaro.
Yep. I don't know how to pronounce his name.
But we have lots of guests. We have lots of people lined up who are excited to be on the show, excited to talk to you, talk to us. It's going to be great. And as always, we're looking for suggestions of what we should do on the show. Yep. So, you know.
Email us.
Yeah. Email us at us on Twitter.
Yeah, I think we're very excited, and it's going to be a good time, and we're meeting all kinds of interesting people, which is really kind of why we started this, I think, in the first place, was to interact with interesting people and talk about interesting things.
Yeah, yeah.
Success.
And now we're doing it.
All I do is win, 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 no matter what.
Yeah.
No.
I love that Emma Stone song.
I can't stand it. Anyway.
Right. Okay. So this episode, though, today, right now, we are talking about the fifth element, air horns.
Oh, yeah. Love that.
It's this is my first time actually watching the fifth element. But, you know, a Luc Besson tradition is a Luc Besson tradition. And I needed to watch the fifth element. So
aren't you just kicking your fourth grade self for not getting into a theater to see it?
I don't know how I didn't watch this a whole lot earlier. Like 12-year-old me would have loved it.
For me, my very vivid memory of the fifth element is I first became aware of it through the newspaper. because there was like newspaper articles about it in the local newspaper, which is crazy to think about learning of anything through a newspaper.
Oh, absolutely.
Just a science fiction movie. But yeah, so I was definitely not allowed to see it because my parents were actually pretty good at not, for the most part, not letting me see things that I shouldn't see. And I got to admit, looking at it now, like I saw it a few years later, but looking at it now, I'm like, this is probably good that a 12-year-old me didn't see this.
Oh, it's for sure. I mean, I'd say that I would have liked it, but it was also very inappropriate.
It would have been bad for you. I think psychologically, I think this is bad for young boys. And I think we'll get into young people in general. Yeah. And I think we'll get into that as we move forward. There's some quite toxic messaging.
Super toxic.
Pretty deeply in there. But I guess, so what's the gist of the fifth element, Marshall? You want to walk us through it?
The gist of the fifth element. Quite obviously there is a great evil in the world that awakens every 5,000 years and threatens all life in the universe. I think it's called the unlife. Unlife will come every 5,000 years and unlife us all.
Yeah, except, we don't know what happened last time.
We know it was defeated last time, and there were Egyptian hieroglyphics that told the story and served as the institutional memory for, I don't know, the alliance of life that fought against unlife.
Unlife, yeah. Makes sense.
And, we discover these hieroglyphics, start to piece them together 300 years before unlife is coming back.
In the 1914. Just before the great unlife war.
And then aliens come back and they take away the keys to using whatever
they take
weapon
away
it
the
is.
Fifth element. Which is the weapon against...
Yeah, I never understood. I mean, I didn't think they took away the fifth element. They took away the other four. I don't know where fifth was.
No, they took the fifth element. They took the statue. So, like, the statue.
Oh, right.
This is going to have spoilers for the 1997 film, The Fifth Element. I'll only warn you about movies from the 90s.
That criteria changes.
It does. It's a sliding scale.
A sliding scale of the 90s.
It's needs-based. It's needs-based.
I missed that part, that they took the sarcophagus, and that was actually the fifth element as well.
Yeah.
So they took the fifth element and the other four elements.
Because the fifth element is ladies.
And these, made up a ginormous weapon that could fend off unlife. I guess the weapon was life.
Yeah, it was life. And so the fifth element has to be procreative
women.
Procreative potential.
Yeah.
So right there, toxic.
And love.
Yeah, love.
Procreative potential.
Yeah. Yeah.
Embodied by love.
Yeah. Love. Yes.
Because you only love someone if you're going to procreate.
The love of procreative heteronormative relationships.
I've only ever felt love for someone in a romantic sense and no other way.
Right, of course.
Because I'm a man. This
gets us into toxic. I think this is like kind of the core toxicity from which kind of everything else sort of like, it just sort of branches out into all kinds of just disgusting.
It really does.
But this movie is just deeply sexist, like from go. It just immediately says basically women are objects for reproducing mass male hegemony, basically.
It's not just basically says, explicitly says women are objects. This woman is mankind's greatest possession.
Yeah, someone does say that of. Anyway,
not like greatest hope. Not greatest weapon. No, greatest possession.
Yeah.
We own her.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think by extension, all women.
Yeah, yeah. Women are the greatest possession that men have. Yeah. Yeah. And so that's
gross.
Yeah. Real icky. All the other gender representations are just permutations on that down the line.
Yeah,
we kind of got out of our order here.
we had a plan. But, you know, plans only last until you start to follow them, and then they go out the window.
Right. So anyway, so these guys, these aliens come, they take away like four little stones and then this big statue sarcophagus thing out of the temple, and they leave. They fuck off to the stars.
Yeah.
They're aliens. And there's this like priest who you never see again. This priest and this archaeologist.
Yep.
And this European, you know, Belgian, presumably, I don't know, archaeologist. And they're there. And then the aliens come, take the stuff away. They fuck off, and we never see those people again. So all we know is that there was this colonial motherfucker who came and showed up in France and was like, or in Egypt, and was like, oh, yes, there's an ancient battle. And then, you know, we also, I guess,
I made this discovery.
Yeah.
Because the people who carved that didn't also know about it.
Yeah. And here's where we learn. I guess the only thing it really teaches us is that there's an order of priests on Earth who are sort of the protectors of the temple and the secret of the fifth element.
Yeah.
And the return of unlife.
Yeah. Dun, dun, dun. And then we jump 300 years into the future. Boom. We're just there. We meet Corbin Dallas.
Yeah.
A cab driver.
Cab driver who's just looking for the perfect woman. That's like the first
thing. What every man wants.
He's on the phone and he's just like, you know, they're talking about ladies and he's got this ex-wife. But he just says, you know, I'm just looking for the perfect one. That the problem was that, you know, not perfect for me, not even like he's even tried to like get out of it a little bit. No, it's like I just want a woman with no human frailties or flaws.
Just that one. Just that one.
Just none of that. Yeah.
Easy.
So yeah. So we know, big sexist. We learn he's a veteran, a greatly decorated war hero. His room is full of like the gaudiest. Ribbons and ornaments. Looks like a 10-year-old after a field day. Yeah. Mother, I got these from army. And the only thing in his room, like his room is very sparse. And he just has a shelf just crammed full of like junky trinkets.
Yeah.
That he got from army, I guess.
Back when life was good.
Yeah. And back when he could drive a tank. He could fly a helicopter. They wouldn't let him win. But yes, anyway, we learn he's a veteran, and now he is, I guess, supposedly reduced to being a cabbie, and probably isn't a very good one because we understand his license is about to be revoked.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the license?
I mean, I really do. Cause at some point he's talking to someone in the cab company,
his boss, who is his army buddy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's how he got the cab job. Yeah. Army buddy was like, well, I can get you a job. So he became a cab driver. And then his buddy's like, how many points you got left on your license? And every time you break the law or make some sort of infraction, the
car
computer in your car identifies the infraction and is like, you broke a rule. You're losing X number of points.
Mm-hmm.
Holy moly.
So we learn and realize because he has a minor collision. Well, someone falls through a ceiling, which the car interprets as a collision.
And you just had a collision.
1 point.
Was it only 1 point?
Yeah, it was only 1 point because he had, or is it 3 points? He had 4 points left, 5 points left. He was deducted.
And he went down
points.
To 1 point. He lost collision. 4 points.
A collision cost him 4 points. And we learn from what he says, is right now, so how much points he has 50.
So, I mean,
so
that's not
a lot
of points.
We know there's
points.
At least 50.
You have 50 points. There was a minor collision. The car doesn't even assess fault.
Mm-hmm.
It just says a collision happened. You lost points.
Yeah,
done. Like there's no blame associated with it. But it's just that something bad happened, and you were associated. So
minus 4 points.
Yeah,
I think we settled.
Which
this, though,
I mean,
this
makes some amount of sense.
This we settled on this that this was a society that developed self-driving car technology, but then just couldn't get over the lack of liability. Like, we got to blame somebody. You're staying behind the wheel, son.
We could have this car drive for you.
But that would put car companies at risk for civil litigation. So therefore, no.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
There is, I guess, some amount of sense of just saying, look, we're going to give you a certain number of points. And if you avoid collisions and you avoid breaking the law, you keep those points. And if you have collisions, it doesn't matter whose fault it is, because collisions are often sort of a combination of fault. It's not like one person or another. It's a combination of...
With the exception of some rear-enders where like somebody just is going way too fast and plows straight into you.
Yeah. And in that case, if that happens to you once in a while when you're driving and you start off with some number of points.
It doesn't matter.
You're fine. You're like, oh, okay, yeah, I lost some points, but whatever. I've got points left. But if you regularly have it happen to you, if you are regularly in fender benders, it's probably because you're just a bad driver.
If you're just looking around wondering who the asshole is, it's probably.
So that license sort of was interesting, and just the we don't care.
This dystopic corporatist panopticon.
We're always watching everything you're doing,
and penalize and billing
and
you.
You'll be punished.
Yeah.
Which then I think also sort of leads into the population sort of question I had around New York, because we see Corbin driving,
mm-hmm.
and he's in his apartment, and I guess he has a garage,
yeah.
like attached to his apartment, like yeah. a parking spot,
mm-hmm.
and not just attached to his building in the sense that we think of them now, that like there's, you know, a parking garage below the building or beside the building or something. No, it's like
an apartment size parking like compartment in the just on his floor.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
With a bay that opens up, and he can actually just pull it into sky traffic because cars fly here.
So everybody's in flying cars, and. There's sort of striations of
traffic
that,
and then you never see
level.
Anyone go between the two.
Never.
No, there's never any vertical or lateral transfer.
So like he's in his garage and he waits, and then whoop, pulls out into traffic immediately. And I mean, I think there's sort of like a joke here that, oh, you can tell you're in New York because the traffic's still bad. Right. Mm-hmm. But the vertical level of traffic.
Where are the interchanges?
and also like traffic is bad in New York because there's a lot of people who live at various levels, but can only drive at one level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
if you can spread that traffic out vertically,
it will actually dissipate.
You should have far less traffic because you just can't fit that many people.
But there's just a volume of people. I also noticed there was like directionality issues as well, like because they were only going one direction.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely.
One level. So in other words, you're going one way, but to go the other way, you then have to go to wherever it is you can go up to go start going the other way.
Oh, I was thinking of that as more like a one-way road. So you just have to take a right and then like go down to the next road and take another right and
right.
go the other direction.
Anyway, cumbersome.
Like, it's super, super cumbersome.
I mean, at that density, you wouldn't want U-turns anyway, but
oh my God. And I didn't understand why anybody would want to live in New York like that,
mm-hmm.
considering that they just, you know, they can hop on a space plane, fall asleep for as long as the flight takes, and be at another planet.
Mm-hmm.
Why would you live on Earth in squalor?
Maybe they can't afford it. Maybe they're trapped there businessly.
They are trapped businessly.
Marshall and I were discussing, we talked about people in Flynn being trapped economically, and Marshall said they're not trapped economically, they're trapped businessly.
Because the economics don't say that they have to stay there.
Businesses do.
Business says that they have to stay there. Business decisions decide that it's not affordable to do something. Not economic decisions.
So I really like it, and I'm making it a thing. So
the resources are there, folks.
We'll put it on a mug.
But I mean, like, yes, space and scarce and housing though stops being scarce when you have interstellar travel that like without the time dilation, sort of like
mm-hmm.
if you don't have to actually expend 20
years of your life traveling to another star system.
Yeah,
yeah.
Then it becomes super affordable to have colonies all over the place.
Yeah, we don't really know how much their faster than light travel costs.
No,
because it's all like airlines or navies, and that's budgeted. So
there was a lot of people getting onto planes.
That's
though.
True, though. Yeah, there was. Yeah.
Anyway,
space planes
and the congestion in New York. Not congestion, the smog, the pollution in New York.
Yeah, it was interesting that the.
Amazing, because like there was a level at which there was a fog that had just enveloped lower New York, and below that it was just toxic fumes.
Yeah, you can't go down. Yeah,
like, and they were like the police were chasing him
under ghetto,
and they were like, "Oh, how are we supposed to find anybody in this fog? We can't see anything."
Yeah,
holy shit.
Well, the cars still burn fuel. Like, they still emit, like, they're emitting gas.
They were on fossil fuels.
Yeah. So,
flying fossil fuel cars.
The energy output of, and these were not aerodynamic vehicles at all. So, it's pretty crazy. But it was one thing I did like. So, apparently, not a lot's changed in New York in the future. The NYPD are certainly the same.
you shoot first.
They are aggressive. Oh, man. You see them, like, rolling up into, like, buildings, up into, like, housing projects and, like, you know, shooting people. And yeah, their cars have like machine guns on them, and they just like let loose in the middle of traffic. And
so
standard NYPD stuff. Good to know they haven't changed even in New York. You can still count on.
In a movie like this, we have Unlife as sort of the great evil, but Every unlife needs
a life.
A proxy.
Yeah.
Right. Somebody who will smooth the way for them. It's like unlife's butler. Like, gets things ready for unlife on his way there. Make sure the planet is prepped.
Prepped and ready. And who is that? Who is that butler?
This is Saint Jean Emmanuel Zorg.
Yes. Right. Yeah. The known arms dealer and otherwise industrialist about town.
Yeah, apparently he just owns all of the businesses.
Yeah, all of the businesses.
He is vertically and horizontally integrated in everything, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we only ever actually hear of him owning two businesses. he owns a large arms company,
and he owns a cab company.
And he owns a cab company.
several cab companies.
Yeah, several cab companies.
Because so at some point we meet Zorg, and he's walking along looking evil and limping
along, because of course he's a man with a physical disability.
Well, that's how you know that he's a bad guy.
That's how you know he's evil, right? Yeah.
And he has a greasy sort of lackey come up to him and is like, the council is very worried about the economy overheating. They think we should fire 500,000 people and that'll calm it down. And Zorg very...
played by Gary Oldman, I think.
Yes, yeah.
In a Texan neck with a Texas accent.
It was great. I really liked the character of Zorg. As in, like, I enjoyed him. Not that I.
I just want to grab a beer with that guy. Because seriously, way better than Gary Oldman.
Yes, the mass murdering Zorg. Better than Oldman in real life. They say, "Oh, we need to lay off 500,000 people, and that'll solve the problem." And Zorg turns to him and says, "Lay off a million." You're like, no. 500,000 should do it. Yep, but I want you to lay off a million. But we don't know what really. I mean,
I guess my thing is there ever really an is there really an economic strategy that would involve you like instituting mass layoffs to avoid economic growth, or to avoid like as a mitigations for like recession or, you know, like overvaluation? Like,
is
that a thing?
This isn't, it's not, it wouldn't be avoiding a recession. Mm-hmm. This is avoiding inflation.
Oh, okay.
Right. The economy is overheated. Right. So, too many people have jobs, right? Yeah. So if you lay off a bunch of those people, then they will look for other jobs and be willing to accept a lower wage.
Currency will get scarcer again, and then.
Right. Or just like demand for labor is such that like if you increase the supply of available labor, wages go down, right?
Right.
So it doesn't really the supply of money doesn't have to change.
Except presumably all those people who are employed are working for companies and doing, you know, and contributing marginal productivity to that company. So for that company just to send workers out doesn't. Like, it's not like these people are being released and then
no,
being
and this is sort of like what makes me wonder the who the council is and what are their motives, right? Like, why are they worried about hyperinflation? unless the council is the government, in which case the government has other policy levers that may or may not work, because I'm not sure that everyone is actually sold on the idea.
You don't know what life is like in New York.
Well, no, I don't know that changing interest rates actually has the known policy effect that we've estimated that it has.
Right.
It doesn't seem to be doing much right now.
Sure. Lord knows what would happen in Nova Neo New York.
uh But an economy that's doing too well. I mean, I guess that's really all that they might be concerned about is that, oh, you know, wages are too high. Like inflation is going up. It's cutting into my profit margins now. Like I have contracts at a certain price and wages going up are right. cutting into the contract. So I can't afford it. And so maybe Zorg is like helping out his buddies by saying, okay, I'll lay off a bunch of people. That'll cool things down. You'll be able to meet your contracts and still be profitable. Right. I mean, but it is very interesting that a businessman would say, oh yes, let me lay off
a million
the source of my income.
Yeah.
Because the economy is doing well.
Yeah.
It just like.
Yeah. That. Yeah. I mean,
it doesn't seem
it's
to
really
track.
Just supposed to make us think he's evil, I think.
And, yes, exactly.
And then that he does it for not for rational business purposes.
Right.
But just because he is evil.
Yeah.
And that's really two ways we know he's evil. Right. One is that he does this unnecessary mass firing.
Yeah. Which anytime you lay off a bunch of people, you're a bad person.
Yeah. Contrary to prudent business sense as well.
Yes.
There wasn't even a reason for it, just because. And then two, there's another reason. Later on, he kills a business associate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. He has a deal with some aliens, and then he backstabs them. Ha-ha!
Yeah. And that's how you know he's a bad person.
He's a bad guy. If you're willing to kill business associates, you are bad.
Yeah.
Like, murdering people is one thing. Sure. That happens.
Bad. But murdering business associates? Firing people? For sadistic pleasure instead of the profit motive? Oh, no.
Well, see, and like, if he had a good reason in this council, obviously he's like, okay, we carried out some simulations, you know, we did a Monte Carlo, and they say 500,000 is going to do it. Who is this, like, leader? It's kind of, it's the seagull style of leadership, right? Like, come in and shit all over everything. And then make a decision. You had competent employees who told you the best course of action, and then you just like, no, do something different. Whoa.
I hear it works very well for Jeff Bezos.
Well, something's working for him. Neoliberalism. Anyway, a million layoffs, cool down the economy.
Yeah. Oh, God.
We don't know what the impact
Jesus
of that is going to be. But we do know the impact is Corbin Dallas loses his job.
Yeah, at the cab company. Dun, dun, dun.
Gets a free lunch.
Yeah, so anyway, and the reason, anyway, so all this basically has to do, though, in the background, there's space president is meeting with space generals, and there's ridiculous periscope shenanigans.
We encounter Unlife somewhere far in the distance.
In space. So the humans reach out to
cold, unforgiving reaches of deep space.
Okay. Anyway, yeah. So Unlife is back, and now there's this huge race to return the stones to the temple. So they reach out to our alien friends, the space crabs. What are their names?
Mondashoans.
The Mondashoans, yes, who are racing back with the fifth element to stop Unlife.
To stop Unlife, yeah.
And at which point they're intercepted and shot down by some space terrorists.
The Mangalores. Right,
the Mangalores, who we'll talk about in more detail later. And they're, of course, working for Zog.
Zorg,
yeah. So anyway, so then there's this whole big thing. Something is recovered from the crash. It's some tissue.
A survivor.
A survivor, yeah. Some tissue is recovered.
I did air quotes there.
Yeah, yeah. And anyway, they use a meat 3D printer to revive this hand.
Yeah, there's a hand in a gauntlet, and they analyze it, and they're like, holy moly, their DNA is just like our DNA, but like packed four times more tightly.
But more so. You mean like a histone? Biology nerds. histones are when DNA is packed like super tightly inside the sperm. It's like eight times the
right
density of a chromosome or something like that.
So you got a lot of good stuff in a small package.
Yeah, a very small package.
So they just analyze it, and then they're like, oh, but you know what we can do? Just grow a new one from this arm, from this hand. We'll just 3D print a new one. Because we have the hand there.
And they do. And what they print is Lilu, who's played by Mila, I'm going to butcher her name.
Jovovich?
Jovovich, is that how you pronounce it?
or something like that.
Yeah, Mila Jovovich, who plays Lilu, the perfect woman, apparently.
The Corbin perfect Dallas. Woman.
Yeah, genetically whatever, gross.
And obviously because they just 3D printed her, she had to be nude.
Yeah, so she's naked and there's...
But don't worry, we have thermal bandages. We'll just throw some thermal bandages on her.
Yeah, so she's very scantily clad for the first part of the film. I guess actually most of it, really.
She spends most of the film scantily clad.
Yeah. So it's just gross male.
They give her clothes briefly.
Male gaze garbage.
And then they soak her so that she has to take off all of those clothes again.
Right. Yes, of course. Good. Yeah. And then this is just a recurring theme with her that she's just always entering into a state of undress.
Always.
So
we talked about some of this like toxicity, but the male gaze is catered to. In this movie.
Aggressively. Uncomfortably so.
And I think that's why we were saying probably best for young kids to not experience this movie. Like this, it would require a lot of intense discussion to understand why this movie is problematic. Mm-hmm. Like...
Yeah. Yeah.
No, women don't just walk around naked and they're not just around for you to stare at. And if you're a young woman, like you don't just have to like
pander to men
who just want to look at you all the time.
Look at you grossly. Yeah. That's actually not acceptable behavior for anyone. Yeah. So anyway, so Lilu,
except for a Supreme Court justice.
Kavanaugh. But anyway, so one thing leads to another. Lilu and Corbin Dallas get together. She falls into his cab. She falls out of the sky, and he's in love.
Boom.
Do anything for her. So anyway, they run from the NYPD. They end up blah, 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 blah. Corbin Dallas ends up taking her to the lone surviving member of this priesthood that guards the fifth element.
I thought the priests were sort of like the Sith, like the rule of two, right? There's like one...
Yeah, one and an apprentice. Yeah, it seems to be the case here anyway. Yeah, so they take her to Ian Holmes' character, Cornelius something. Yeah, Cornelius. And then there's more gross. And you have... So Ian Holmes is then just gross towards her. So, oh, she's perfect.
Oh, yeah.
More gross.
Oh,
more
God.
Gross stuff. Then Corbin Dallas is shunted aside. Then the military gives him the exact same mission that the priest and Lilu are going on. They get back together. They go to this planet, Foston Paradise, to meet this diva.
They meet Ruby Rod.
Ruby Rod, yeah.
Miss
yeah,
Ruby yeah. Rod.
This movie gets really convoluted because at some point, like, Corbin is winning a contest. Like to go, yeah. He's winning like a radio contest.
There's a convenient
to meet a DJ,
yeah,
yeah, on a planet on like a resort planet. Oh my god! Just
and that exact resort planet is where the Stones are going to be.
Where the Stones are going to be with this opera singer, of course, because you have to have an opera singer.
Okay, you say that sort of disparagingly, but that opera scene is probably one of the best, most beautiful
part of the movie.
Yeah,
yeah, and I think Luc Besson like wasn't directed like. Diva, the French movie from the 90s, which is actually one of my favorite movies. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. part of the whole cinema of look thing. Anyway, but all this to say, yeah, so they go to meet an opera singer to get the stones, the other four stones. Needless to say, Zorg tries to interfere. There's gun battles and shootouts.
Lots of gun battles.
Let's talk about Ruby Rod.
I don't know how to feel about Ruby Rod.
Yeah, it's true. Because on the one hand, this character is kind of has some sort of queer coding.
Yep. It's
fairly androgynous. So it's played by uses, she's they are played by Chris Tucker.
I mean, even at this point, I don't know what pronouns to use. The character is introduced as Miss Ruby Rod. Later, I think people are using a masculine pronoun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is definitely referred to as a he at some point.
I don't know, maybe that's, but it's weird to have somebody introduced as a miss mm-hmm. and then later have a he. And maybe they, you know, yeah. that's just how they identify mm-hmm. and that's fine.
He
dresses in identifiably feminine clothing.
Yeah.
And has a lot of
very high-pitched voice.
High-pitched voice and some feminine behaviors.
Yeah.
But is clearly masculine.
Yeah.
In it's other like, forms of presentation.
Yeah, right? And it's very like you know, like suggestive with women. And I think there's this one. There's a scene where like the ship is taking off, the shuttle is taking off from Earth, and there's this whole like blast off scene that's linked to him. You know, it's intimated that he's
performing cunnilingus.
Bringing this woman to orgasm through cunnilingus, and you know, it's just actually pretty gross.
And so this is why in some ways it's interesting.
In a long sequence.
Very long. Like it went on and on.
And then they stop in the middle of it to be like, and then they go like, yeah, the ground crew underneath changing the fuel rods in the reactor. And they're like these Jamaican dudes and they're smoking weed. And it's like, why are we doing this?
There's a lot of times in the movie that I wonder what are you doing?
And they're like, yeah, no. Oh.
I mean, that was there so that the priest had a way to get on the plane.
Oh, yeah. That is actually why that was there.
I don't know why he needed it on the plane, but he did. So, but the thing that I found interesting about Ruby Rod is that even though there was sort of a feminine presentation, basically everybody was supposed to find Ruby Rod sexually attractive.
Mm-hmm.
Men, women, other... Everyone looked at Ruby Rod and was like, oh my, I want some of that. And Ruby was sort of free to pick and choose.
Yeah, and it is very sexual and everyone is just expected to respond.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's
it wasn't a negative that it was a feminine presentation. It was like, well, yeah, but that's just how Ruby is. Ruby Rod is very sexually successful.
Yeah.
Does not seem to have any problem finding willing partners. That's really great to say, you know, look, we have this queer character and everyone. So in some ways, Ruby Rod is like very subversive for 1997.
Weirdly. But then also, I mean, like there's this whole thing of again, with the male gaze piece, there's like on this aircraft, there's these stewardesses who are in a very, very scant costuming. And he just like walks up to one of these women and just immediately begins touching her. And of course, she's just so into it. Like it's you see how that's kind of like a woman in a service position being approached by a wealthy and powerful man who just immediately presumes to, you know, be all a pawns, and she's just, you know, expected to like it and go along with it. And that's
icky. Absolutely. That's icky
for sure. So yeah. Anyway, layers.
Yeah.
This is it's a bizarre sequence. And it's interesting because he's, you know, because I think there's gender, but I think there's also race. Mm-hmm. In the sense that he kind of becomes Corbin's sidekick for the main action sequence of the movie. He's like, he's just freaking out and yelling, and it's very cowardly in the battle.
And yet very successful.
Yeah, but at times is very helpful to him. Yeah, either by accidentally bumbling into like knocking something over and, you know, like causing guys to fall down, or actually just, you know, mustering the courage to be helpful at a critical moment. But, you know, he kind of ends up being like this sort of like, yeah, like squire for Corbin. And I think when you entangle that with the race, it becomes kind of like, it becomes weird again.
Yes, very weird again. Yeah.
But anyway, they meet the diva, they get the stones, they go back to Earth, they kill on life, basically.
And then Corbin
and Lilu get to...
But they kill the Unlife, so they get the stones. There's a whole puzzle they have to solve. The stones are all in place, and then they're like, okay, well, now we just put the fifth element in place, and nothing happens. And then Corbin goes up and is talking to Lilu and is like, come on, you can do this. And off on the side, you see the priest being like, it's love.
Kiss the girl.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then when Corbin admits to loving Lilu, she's like, she has just said, but I don't know what love is. And he says, I love you. And she's like, oh, that clarifies it for me.
Thank you. Yes.
And all then right. is able to serve as conduit for this ultimately powerful weapon.
And there's a scene earlier where he tries to kiss her and she slaps him and says, don't ever touch me without my consent again.
Yeah, never.
Basically,
without,
never without permission. Never without permission. Tells him, you know, and then of course, numerous times after that, you know, has bad boundaries with her and presumes upon her physically, and Yeah, yeah, gross.
But they fell in love. And
yeah, so it was fine. Again, in the bounds of a heteronormative sexual relationship, there are no boundaries, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's okay to predate upon somebody as long as eventually it's reciprocal.
Yeah, yeah, which not true.
That's not true.
Not true at all.
When somebody says, don't touch me without my permission, don't touch them without their permission.
Yeah. And that's just good advice for anybody, like anyone to anyone else. Just don't be touching people without their permission.
Ever.
Yeah. Yeah. There's really no good reason for it. And that kind of brings us to the end. So in the end, the thing that battles the evil force of genocidal unlife is missionary positions. So,
yeah, procreative love.
Procreative, heteronormative love. So there you go. The other thing I want to talk about, I do want to, my last aside here, I think for me, is this business about the Mangalores, who are these alien terrorist characters who are in the background, who are, again, coded as black, which is weird. And then two, I guess in a very liminal way.
Okay, you say coded.
But no, like
it's not
like,
coded.
Yeah,
it's explicitly.
They
because
they're like, in their human form.
Yeah, the Mangalores can shapeshift.
Yeah,
and when they do shapeshift from being weird, sort of goblin-y things, they're all black. Every Mangalore that we see,
yeah, with two exceptions, but yes, predominantly they shapeshift.
Oh no, there are those
people.
There are two.
But they predominantly shapeshift into black people. So there's that, and then we find very liminally that like the Mangalores have been like the Federation, like the humans, have hunted them down, killed a large number of them, and placed them onto. I think the word reservation is actually even used. Or like they're like
hunted. I can't corroborate.
They
but
say
they
hunted down or something like that. But anyway, clearly
and left on like desolate planets.
Yeah, left in desolate planets. So clearly these are like displaced people. Impacted by human imperialism, and they're working with Zog to get weapons to continue on their liberation struggle against the colonizers. And these are the bad guys of this story.
The Mangalores are bad guys.
Yeah. Ooh, we hate them. Ooh, we hates them. But, you know, I think, everything we learn about them indicates that they're, you know,
they're in a struggle for survival.
Yeah, for survival against the very society that we're supposed to be rooting for. And yet somehow that's their problem. So it's just, you know, who obviously potentially I think these are the people that Corbin was fighting in the war to begin with. So, you know, it's messed up is what it is. It's just,
yeah. And I mean, this sort of thing just like gets to the heart of the Luc Besson movies that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
That there's the layers, right? On a surface level, they're all very pretty. Jean-Paul Gaultier was doing costume design on this. The comic artist Mobius was brought in to do some like set design stuff. So visually, the movie is spectacular. The costumes are great, and it's very easy to sort of just like sit back and enjoy the
spectacle.
But then you like you peel away that layer. And you're like, oh wow! So like this is a future that is just like unabashedly, ruthlessly capitalist.
Yeah.
Far in the future, it's sexist. It appears to be racist. There are power dynamics that are just not great. The cops just like enter a building, see somebody's name, do no further investigation, and kill the occupant just because he was a bit belligerent and they thought he was the target.
Yeah.
So they just killed him. Like, that kind of power is something that should not be celebrated.
Mm-hmm. But it is. But it is. But it is. In our, it this is our culture. This is our society.
Yeah, and so it's all of these gross things that are like, every time you peel away a layer, you might encounter something that you're like, oh, this could be good. And then immediately the layer after that is like, oh, but maybe it's not.
This is poop.
Oh,
that's poop. Yeah, that's poop.
but it's all tied together with this visually and it's all enjoyable.
It's all on display. All the worst parts of our society are just really put in here, just
And never critiqued.
And never critiqued, no.
Like, they're put out there, and they're like, yeah, but we're the heroes. We're genocidal, and we're capitalist, you know, with no cares.
Yeah, but sure, we commit genocide, but who would you rather have? A genocidal empire, or something that kills everything alive?
Yeah, exactly.
Huh? Because that's what it takes when you're those people. Like, the only bad guy you can conceivably find is something that will just literally kill everyone for no reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, that's the only thing that could be worse
than
you. Only thing worse than the U.S. Empire is maybe something that just would kill all humans.
Yeah.
So, yay.
Like, so, anyway, that's sort of my... I'm like, Luc Besson, I like watching your movies, but man, they should be all like R-rated, like 18A.
Not for children.
You need to have like a film studies docent in the theater. Now we're just going to pause the film here and let's just discuss that last scene. Because these are things that shouldn't just be... absorbed
uncritically.
Yeah,
so I don't know, Marshall, that kind of does it for me.
That wraps it all up. Yeah, this is the first episode of season two. We've run a little longer here than we were planning.
Worth it.
Yeah, it was totally worth it. Well, I mean, I felt it was worth it. If you disagree with me, at me, bro.
Yeah, please get in touch with us. I think we're going to come up with some. We definitely will get better at responding to your comments, I think, and reading people's comments on the air if we get them. So we'll be watching for those. And if you want us to respond to something, please let us know. We'd be happy to speak to you.
You can find us on Twitter at AssetDroid. If you know that public square is not your style, do feel free to email us. I'm Marshall at androidsandassets.ca.
And I'm Steve at androidsandassets.ca. And please, you can also hit us up on our Insta.
You can find us on Insta, yeah, at AssetDroid as well. We're gonna try and get some more stuff up on Instagram for you because we know you like pictures. Get those dopamine receptors firing.
Pictures of us from the beach this summer. Yeah, and you can find us wherever fine podcasts are available.